the British spell it Taliban, T-A-L-E-B-A-N, and Texas. And lo and behold, look what popped up on my computer. A BBC story from December of 1997. Taliban to Texas for pipeline talks. The Taliban, as you know, were invited to come to Texas while you were governor of the state. According to the BBC, the Taliban went there to meet with Unocal, the huge oil and energy giant, to discuss Unocal's desire to build a natural gas pipeline running from Turkmenistan through Taliban-controlled Afghanistan and into Pakistan. Mr. Bush, what was this all about? According to London's Telegraph Online, your oil company friends rolled out the red carpet for some of the world's most notorious, murderous thugs and showed them a real good down-home Texas time. First, the Taliban leader spent a few days in Sugarland, Texas, enjoying the pleasures of Western extravagance. The oil men put the brutal bastards up in a 5-star hotel, took them to the zoo, and of course, to the NASA Space Center. Houston, we have a problem, apparently never crossed your mind, even though the Taliban were perhaps the most repressive fundamentalist regime on the planet. If the reverse had happened, and they were hosting you in Kabul, the entertainment would have been the hanging of women who didn't keep themselves covered from head to toe. Now that would have been some barbecue, huh? After Texas, the Taliban dictators moseyed on over to Washington, D.C., where they met with Carl Inderfirth, Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs. Then they went to Omaha, where the University of Nebraska eventually created a special training program for Afghanis to teach them how to build pipelines, all paid for by your friends at Unocal. During one of their visits there, in May 1998, two Taliban members, this time in the U.S. sponsored by Clinton State Department, took in some more sites, including the Badlands National Park, the Crazy Horse Memorial, Gerald Ford's birthplace, and Mount Rushmore. Yes, it was an amazing amount of hospitality, a fine example of American goodwill and our big generous hearts. Or our love of money and cheap energy. Heck, if the price is right, we'll give anyone a chance. As you know, in the former Soviet republics east of the Caspian Sea, there's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of natural gas and oil just waiting to be tapped. Everyone was trying to get in on the rush, and the U.S. government was more than eager to help them. Even President Clinton was all for the idea of the Unocal pipeline. The trick to getting our hands on all this booty was in beating the Russians to it, and we had to find a way to access it without having to build a pipeline through hostile Iran. So while Unocal came up with the idea of running a pipeline through Afghanistan, Enron had been working on their own plan to bring gas from Turkmenistan and pipe it under the Caspian Sea and into Turkey. The U.S. government actually paid for Enron's feasibility study. Enron was also busy with neighboring Uzbekistan, where it was trying to strike deals to develop natural gas fields there. In late 1996, Unocal had begun looking into including Uzbekistan in its pipeline deal heading through Afghanistan and into Pakistan. And then you, Mr. Bush, decided to get in on the action. You met personally with Uzbekistan's ambassador on behalf of Enron. Enron chairman Ken Lay ended a letter to you prior to the meeting with this little bon mot. I know you and Ambassador Safayev will have a productive meeting which will result in a friendship between Texas and Uzbekistan. Sincerely, Ken. What role exactly did you play in the Unocal meetings with the Taliban? I'm guessing you knew that the leaders of a foreign country were visiting your state and meeting with people who were donors to your campaign. So why exactly were brutal dictators being wined and dined in your state when you seemed to be so against brutal dictators? Of course, to be fair, you weren't the only one trying to help others make a buck from what is believed to be the world's last vast untapped reserves of oil and gas. There was the Clinton White House, Henry Kissinger, and another former Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, all of them willing to lend a hand. And, of course, there was Dick Cheney. Cheney was then the CEO of the giant oil services company, Halliburton. When not building jails in Guantanamo Bay, ignoring massive human rights violations in order to do business with Burma, and working deals with Libya, Iran, and Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which Halliburton did happily in the 90s, Halliburton built and still builds oil and gas pipelines. In 1998, your future co-president, Mr. Cheney, had this to say about the situation in that part of the world. "I can't think of a time when we've had a region emerge as suddenly to become as strategically significant as the Caspian. It's almost as if the opportunities have arisen overnight." And in a talk to the Cato Institute the same year, he revealed this information about Halliburton. "About 70-75% of our business is energy-related, serving customers like Unocal, Exxon, Shell, Chevron, and many other major oil companies around the world. As a result, we oftentimes find ourselves operating in some very difficult places. The good Lord didn't see fit to put oil and gas only where there are democratically elected regimes friendly to the United States. Occasionally, we have to operate in places where, all things considered, one would not normally choose to go. But we go where the business is." Yes, there certainly was business in Afghanistan. After the Soviets were repelled in their occupation of Afghanistan by U.S.-backed Mujahideen fighters like Osama bin Laden, the U.S. quickly forgot about Afghanistan and let chaos take over. The country plunged into civil war. When the Taliban rose to power in the mid-90s, they were met with absolute glee in Washington. Initially, the Taliban were thought to be following the U.S.-approved Saudi Arabian model of good government, strong-hand oppression while giving the West what it needed. This made them a country we could play ball with. Quickly, however, their murderous ways came to light, and American political leaders began to back off. But not the oil companies. Unocal stuck it out and plunged on with their pipeline deal with the Taliban, teaming up with Saudi-owned Delta Oil. Delta is headed by a man named Mohammed Hussein al-Amoudi, who has been investigated for ties to Osama bin Laden. It didn't seem to bother either party that Osama bin Laden had taken up residence in Afghanistan, with the Taliban's blessing, in 1996, the same year he first issued his call for holy war against the United States. That kill all the Americans jihad talk didn't bother your close friends at Enron either. In addition to their plan to pipe the Caspian's natural gas all the way to the Mediterranean, Ken Lay and his associates were also hard at work on another great scam. They were building a giant natural gas-powered energy plant in Dabhol, India. The Dabhol plant, like everything else Enron cooked up, including your campaign, was a titanic ripoff. And who better to screw the indigent people of India than the same company that screwed its own American employees and customers? But, George, I'm curious about something else here. Can you tell me if it was just coincidence that Enron and Unocal were in the same region, one building a natural gas power plant and the other building a natural gas pipeline? Was there something else going on here? See, this is how it looks to me, and please, George, feel free to tell me if I am wrong. Unocal would pay off the Taliban to build their pipeline through Afghanistan and into Pakistan. They were then planning to build an extension on that pipeline that would run into India and stop at New Delhi. At the same time, Enron was planning to build a pipeline from Dabhol to New Delhi where, of course, it could meet up with the Turkmen pipeline, bringing Unocal and Enron together. An alternate Unocal plan had the pipeline terminating at the Arabian Sea in Pakistan, where the gas could be exported. Enron's Dabhol plant would have been a quick tanker ride away. But then Osama blew up two American embassies in Africa, and that was enough for President Clinton to decide he no longer wanted anything to do with Afghanistan. He responded to bin Laden by firing missiles into a Sudanese aspirin factory and a deserted al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan. I guess one thing you and every other business student learned in school is that once your country bombs the country you're trying to do business with, the deal is pretty much off. So 2 days later, UNIKEL suspended their involvement with the Taliban to build the pipeline in Afghanistan and pulled out of the deal completely 3 months later. Suddenly, the Taliban were out billions of dollars, money they desperately needed to fund their regime and to protect bin Laden. I'm not certain, but I would guess, Mr. Bush, that the Taliban were mighty pissed off at UNIKEL and the Americans for going back on such a lucrative deal. One thing I do know about these crazy Taliban, they hold some mean grudges. But one thing was clear to your friends at Enron and UNIKEL and Halliburton, Mr. Bush. The Taliban and Osama bin Laden really screwed business up with these two terrorist acts, and Clinton shut the deal down. So, as long as the Taliban were around and giving a home to Osama, that pipeline would never be built. What would be the solution? A new president wouldn't hurt. Clinton was never going to let UNIKEL, Halliburton, and Enron be in business with these terrorists. So Enron became one of the biggest contributors to your campaign to unseat the Clinton-Gore axis. Cheney, hired to pick your vice president, ended up picking himself. Then he picked a bunch of your dad's friends for the other top spots, and you said okay. Then you got appointed president by the Supreme Court. And then you weren't in office a month when the Taliban came a knocking on your door. They still wanted those billions from the pipeline deal. 6 days after Cheney set up his secret energy task force, the London Times reported that the Taliban were offering to work out a deal with the new administration that would have involved kicking Osama out of Afghanistan, and had conveyed this to you. Everyone was looking for a little quid pro quo, and it just so happened that you'd installed Zalmay Khalilzad, a former UNIKEL consultant, in your administration. Khalilzad, now a member of Condoleezza Rice's National Security Council, had attended a dinner for the Taliban during the UNIKEL meetings in Texas. In October 1996, he told Time magazine that the Taliban are not into exporting revolution, nor are they hostile to the U.S. To sweeten the pot, the Taliban had recently joined America's war on drugs. As Afghanistan was responsible for 75% of the world's poppy crop, the prime ingredient of heroin, this was good news to you. The Taliban banned all poppy cultivation and, after an international delegation traveled to the country and declared it poppy-free, you wasted no time in granting $43 million in humanitarian aid to the ravaged country. The aid was to be distributed by international organizations. This is the kind of aid that our government has almost always refused to give to places like Cuba and a host of other countries in the past. But suddenly the Taliban were okay. Of course, the Taliban still had huge stockpiles of heroin sitting around in warehouses, which they continued to sell. If you pretty much control the market for an in-demand substance, and then you drastically cut the availability of that product, even a failed businessman like you, George, could see what would happen. Prices will go up, up, up. As Foreign Policy in Focus has reported, that meant a kilo of heroin went from $44 to $700. And that's all pure profit in your evil, freedom-hating pocket if you're the Taliban. According to various reports, representatives of your administration met with the Taliban or conveyed messages to them during the summer of 2001. What were those messages, Mr. Bush? Were you discussing their offer to hand over bin Laden? Were you threatening them with a use of force? Were you talking to them about a pipeline? Did you and your administration, as one former CIA operative suggested to the Washington Post, foul up a chance to get bin Laden into American custody? Whatever the case, the talks continued until just days before September 11. There would be no pipeline. The Taliban were out the loot, and the companies who supported you had now lost millions themselves on all the prep that went into this lucrative pipeline. What was going to happen next? Well, we know what happened. Two planes took down the World Trade Center and another one crashed into the Pentagon. A fourth plane went down in Pennsylvania. And you decided to protect our freedom by taking some of our freedoms away. Then we swooped into Afghanistan and sent the Taliban and their Al-Qaeda buddies running, which was a hell of a lot easier than catching them. Most of the big shots escaped. Oh, and we turned Afghanistan over to UNICAL. The new American ambassador to Afghanistan? UNICAL consultant and National Security Council member Zalmay Khalilzad. And the newly American installed leader of Afghanistan? Former UNICAL staffer Hamid Karzai. On December 27, 2001, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan signed a pipeline deal. The gas will eventually flow from the Caspian Sea region, and all of your friends will be happy. Something here just doesn't smell right, Mr. Bush. But it can't be the natural gas. Natural gas is odorless. Question number 7. What exactly was that look on your face in the Florida classroom on the morning of September 11 when your chief of staff told you America is under attack? On the afternoon of September 10, you flew down to Florida. Staying in an upscale Sarasota resort, you had dinner with brother Jeb and then went to sleep. In the morning, you took a jog on the golf course and then headed to Booker Elementary to read to little children. You left the resort between 8:30 a.m. and 8:40 a.m., a good 10 to 20 minutes after the FAA knew they had hijacked planes in the air. No one bothered to tell you. You arrived at the school after the first plane had hit the North Tower in New York City. 3 months later, you told a third grader at a town hall meeting in Orlando that you were sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower. The TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. I said, it must have been a horrible accident, but I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. You repeated that same story a month later in another town hall gathering in California. The only problem with the story is that you didn't see the first plane hit the tower. No one saw it live on TV, as the tape wasn't aired until the next day. But that's okay. We all were confused that morning. You entered the classroom around 9 a.m., and the second plane hit the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. Just a few minutes later, as you were sitting in front of the class of kids, listening to them read, your chief of staff, Andrew Card, entered the room and whispered in your ear. Card apparently was telling you about the second plane and the part about us being under attack. And it was at that very moment that your face went into a distant glaze. Not quite a blank look, but one that seemed partially paralyzed. No emotion was shown. And then you just sat there. You sat there for another 7 minutes or so doing nothing. It was, to say the least, weird, creepy. You just stayed there in your little kid's chair and listened to children read, listening peacefully for 5 or 6 minutes. You didn't look worried. You didn't excuse yourself. You weren't rushed from the room by your advisors or the Secret Service. George, what were you thinking? What was going on inside your head? What did that look on your face mean? Of all the questions I've asked you, it is this one that has me totally stumped. Were you thinking you should have taken the reports the CIA had given you the month before more seriously? You had been told Al-Qaeda was planning attacks in the United States, and that planes would possibly be used. There had been previous intelligence reports talking of Al-Qaeda's interest in attacking the Pentagon. Were you saying to yourself at that moment, well, thank God they didn't fly into the Pentagon? Or were you just scared shitless? It's okay if you were. We all were. Nothing wrong with that. Except you have taken on the mantle of commander-in-chief, and that means you have to command when we are under attack, not just sit frozen in a chair. Or maybe you were just thinking, I did not want this job in the first place. This was supposed to be Jeb's job. He was the chosen one. Why me? Why me, Daddy? Hey, we understand, and we don't blame you. You looked like a lost puppy who just wanted to go home. Suddenly, this was not the party you thought it would be, and you were no longer the CEO president. You were now expected to be the warrior president. And we know what happened the last time you were expected to perform in a military uniform. Or maybe, just maybe, you were sitting there in that classroom chair thinking about your Saudi friends, both the royals and the bin Ladens, people you knew all too well that might have been up to no good. Would questions be asked? Would suspicions arise? Would the Democrats have the guts to dig into your family's past with these people? No, don't worry, never a chance of that. Would the truth ever come out? Within the hour, you were on a plane. Not back to Washington, D.C., to lead the nation in its defense and comfort a frightened citizenry, not even to nearby MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, where the Army Central Command is located. No, you ran, first to Louisiana, and then halfway across the country to Nebraska to go into hiding underground. How reassuring that was for the rest of us. For weeks afterward, you and your people pushed the phony story that it was for your own safety because you yourself were the intended target of Al-Qaeda. Of course, the problem with that story is that any dunderhead knew that if hijacked planes are being used as missiles, the last place you want to be is up there flying around in the air in a big target called Air Force One. Maybe someday we will learn what that was all about. To me and millions of others, it just looked chicken shit. And I guess by late afternoon, you figured it looked like that too, and you knew you had better hightail it back to the White House where you could look presidential. From the moment your chopper landed on the South Lawn that evening, your presidency was something no one would or should dare question again. Two nights later, according to a New Yorker article written by Elsa Walsh, you went out to the Truman balcony of the White House to relax and smoke a cigar. It had been a horrific 48 hours, and you needed to wind down. In that private moment, you asked one close friend to join you. As he came in the White House, the two of you embraced. Then you took him out to the balcony where he had a drink that you offered him. The two of you then lit up your cigars and stared out across the ellipse toward the Washington Monument. You told him that if we can't get them, any Al-Qaeda operatives who may have been involved in the attack, to cooperate, we'll hand them over to you. It was an offer that I am sure he appreciated. After all, he was your good friend, Bandar Bush, the prince from Saudi Arabia. As the smoke from the ashes still billowed through the air over Manhattan and Arlington, the smoke from the Saudi prince's cigar wafted through the balmy night air of Washington, D.C., with you, George W. Bush, by his side. These are my seven questions, Mr. Bush. Seven questions that I believe you should answer. The 3,000 dead and their surviving loved ones deserve no less. And a nation of millions is sooner or later going to want to know the truth and demand you come clean or leave. Chapter 2, Home of the Whopper. What is the worst lie a president can tell? I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. Or, he has weapons of mass destruction, the world's deadliest weapons, which pose a direct threat to the United States, our citizens, and our friends and allies. One of those lies got a president impeached. The other lie not only got the liar who told it the war he wanted, but also resulted in huge business deals for his friends and virtually assures him a landslide victory in the next election. Sure, we've been lied to before. Lots of lies, big lies, little lies, lies that brought us down in the eyes of the world. I am not a crook was a lie, and it sent Richard Nixon packing. Read my lips, no new taxes wasn't so much a lie as a broken promise, but it nonetheless cost the first Bush his presidency. Ketchup is a vegetable was technically not a lie, but it was a good example of the Reagan administration's whacked view of the world. Other presidents lied about Vietnam, lied about Korea, lied about the Indians, lied about all men being equal as they kept their personal slaves chained up in the backyard, boatloads of lies for hundreds of years. And when caught in their lies, they were disgraced, punished, or removed. Sometimes. Maybe the reason Bush is still here is that he proved the old adage that if you tell a lie long enough and often enough, sooner or later, it becomes the truth. As the lies that led us into the Iraq War started to unravel and be exposed, the Bush administration went into survival mode with their only defensive maneuver. Keep repeating the lie over and over and over again until the American people are so worn down they'll scream, "Uncle," and start believing it. But nothing can hide this indisputable fact. There is no worse lie than one told to scare mothers and fathers enough to send their children off to fight a war that did not need to be fought because there never was any real threat at all. To falsely tell a nation's citizens that their lives are in jeopardy just so you can settle your own personal score, "He tried to kill my daddy," or to make your rich friends even richer, well, in a more just world, there would be a special prison cell in Joliet reserved for that type of liar. George W. Bush has turned the White House into the home of the Whopper, telling one lie after another, all in pursuit of getting his dirty little war. It worked. I like Whoppers. Flame-broiled, juicy, chock-full of onions and lettuce and loads of secret ingredients. They're big, too. Bigger than a Big Mac. You don't even need to say, "Biggie size it, please," because it's already so damn big. But I know Whoppers are bad for me, so I've given them up. George W. Bush likes Whoppers, too. His are huge, Texas-sized. They're cooked up by a whole crew of people, and then he delivers them, and the American people gobble them up. One Whopper after another. Big, juicy ones. And they go down nice and easy. The more the people eat, the more they want, and the more they think like Mr. Bush. They begin to believe everything he says because his Whoppers are just so irresistibly good. Bush's Whoppers are available in all shapes and sizes and configurations. Allow me to present to you the tasty menu the Whopper in Chief served up special just for you. I'll call them the Iraq War Combo Meals. Number 1. The Original Whopper. Iraq has nuclear weapons. There is no greater way to scare a population than to say there is a madman on the loose and he has, or is building, nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons he intends to use on you. George W. Bush laid the groundwork for scaring us silly early on. In his speech to the United Nations in September 2002, Bush said with a straight face that Saddam Hussein has defied all these efforts and continues to develop weapons of mass destruction. The first time we may be completely certain he has a nuclear weapons is when, God forbid, he uses one. Soon after, on October 7, Bush told a crowd in Cincinnati, "If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year. Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud." How to sway the American public from its initial reluctance to go to war with Iraq? Just say mushroom cloud and boom. Watch those poll numbers turn around. In addition to uranium from Africa, Bush said the Iraqis had attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. Frightening stuff. Imagine how much more frightening if it was actually true. Joseph Wilson, a senior American diplomat with more than 20 years of experience, including positions in Africa and Iraq, was sent to Niger in 2002 on a CIA-directed mission to investigate the British claims that Iraq had tried to buy yellowcake uranium from Niger. He concluded that the allegations were false. Later, Wilson said, "Based on my experience with the administration in the months leading up to the war, I have little choice but to conclude that some of the intelligence related to Iraq's nuclear weapons program was twisted to exaggerate the threat. The CIA asked if I would travel to Niger to check out the story. In early March, I arrived back in Washington and submitted a detailed briefing to the CIA. There should be at least 4 documents in the United States government archives confirming my mission. In July 2003, Wilson also had this to say. It really comes down to the administration misrepresenting the facts on an issue that was a fundamental justification for going to war. It begs the question, what else are they lying about? The White House ignored Wilson's report and instead kept the hoax alive. When the administration persisted with the fabricated story, one official, according to the New York Times, said, "People winced and thought, why are you repeating this trash?" The documents from Niger were so badly faked that the Niger foreign minister who signed one of them was no longer in the government. In fact, he had been, unbeknownst to the British or American liars who made up the story, out of office for more than a decade. The aluminum tubes discovery also turned out to be a fictitious threat. On January 27, 2003, the day before Bush's State of the Union address, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, told the UN Security Council that 2 months of inspections in Iraq had produced no evidence of prohibited activities at former Iraqi nuclear sites. In addition, El-Baradei said the aluminum tubes, unless modified, would not be suitable for manufacturing centrifuges. According to reports in the Washington Post, Newsweek, and other publications, the assertion that the tubes could be used for nuclear weapons production had already been questioned by U.S. and British intelligence officials. UN inspectors said they had found proof that Iraq planned to use the tubes to build small rockets, not nuclear weapons, and the Iraqis were not trying to buy the equipment in secret. Their purchase order was accessible on the internet. But Mr. Bush didn't let facts stand in the way of his tough-talking State of the Union address to almost 62 million viewers on January 28, 2003. Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa, he stated. Imagine those 19 hijackers with other weapons and other plans, this time armed by Saddam Hussein. It would take one vial, one canister, one crate slipped into this country to bring a day of horror like none we have ever known. We will do everything in our power to make sure that that day never comes. On March 16, co-president Dick Cheney appeared on Meet the Press and told the nation that Hussein has been absolutely devoted to trying to acquire nuclear weapons. And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons. 3 days later, we went to war. In the spring and summer of 2003, criticism of the administration's reliance on lies about Iraq's nuclear capabilities heated up to the point that even President Bush could no longer ignore it or put a stop to the questions just by acting cranky. First, he tried to make CIA Director George Tenet the sacrificial lamb. The CIA approved the president's State of the Union address before it was delivered, Tenet was ordered to say in July. I am responsible for the approval process in my agency, and the president had every reason to believe that the text presented to him was sound. These 16 words, regarding the African uranium, should never have been included in the text written for the president. But then came the memos from October that showed that Tenet's CIA did tell the White House not to make such a bogus claim. While the White House initially took this advice, they repeatedly disregarded it afterwards, most notably in the State of the Union. The next scapegoat became Condoleezza Rice's deputy, Stephen Hadley, who said it was he who approved the language in Bush's January address. This looked so lame that finally Bush, in a rare press conference on July 30, said that he and he alone is responsible for any words that come out of his mouth. That those words even need to be said should make an entire nation wonder whether this guy should be the leader of the free world or flipping Whoppers at the Waco Burger King. Number 2. Whopper with cheese. Iraq has chemical and biological weapons. In his October 7, 2002 address from Cincinnati, George W. Bush offered up this freshly cooked Whopper. Some ask how urgent this danger is to America and the world. The danger is already significant, and it only grows worse with time. If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons? Then, just a few months later, Bush added the cheese. We have sources that tell us that Saddam Hussein recently authorized Iraqi field commanders to use chemical weapons, the very weapons the dictator tells us he does not have. Who wouldn't want to bomb that bastard Saddam after hearing that? Then Secretary of State Colin Powell went even further. He said that the Iraqis weren't just concocting chemical weapons, they were doing it on wheels. One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents, Powell told the United Nations. We know that Iraq has at least 7 of these mobile biological agent factories. He went on with such specifics that it had to be true. A missile brigade outside Baghdad was dispersing rocket launchers and warheads containing biological warfare agents. Most of the launchers and warheads had been hidden in large groves of palm trees and were to be moved every 1 to 4 weeks to escape detection. Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agents. That is enough agent to fill 16,000 battlefield rockets. But after invading Iraq, the U.S. Army couldn't find a single one of these mobile labs. After all, with so many palm trees to hide them under, who could blame our Army for not uncovering them? We couldn't find any of the chemical or biological weapons either, even though on March 30, 2003, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had said on ABC's This Week, "We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat." Oh, okay, that's clear. Now we'll find them. Thank you, Mad Hatter. Finally, on July 5, 2003, George W. Bush declared, "We recently found 2 mobile biological weapons facilities, which were capable of producing biological agents. This is the man who spent decades hiding tools of mass murder. He knew the inspectors were looking for them." That whopper lasted about a day. An official British investigation into the 2 trailers found in northern Iraq concluded they are not mobile germ warfare labs, as was claimed by Tony Blair and George Bush, but were for the production of hydrogen to fill artillery balloons, as the Iraqis have continued to insist. That was it. Tanks to fill up balloons. Weapons of mass balloonery. It was more than a little embarrassing for the American commanders in the field. Lieutenant General James Conway, commander of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in Iraq, said, "It was a surprise to me then, it remains a surprise to me now, that we have not uncovered weapons, as you say, in some of the forward dispersal sites. Believe me, it's not for lack of trying. We've been to virtually every ammunition supply point between the Kuwaiti border and Baghdad, but they're simply not there." There never were any chemical or biological weapons, other than the ones we gave Saddam in the 1980s, the ones he used on the Kurds, and the ones he used on the Iranians after we supplied him with the satellite photos so he could locate the Iranian troop movements. We knew why he wanted those photos, and less than a year after the UN reported the gassing of the Iranians, we reinstated full diplomatic relations with his regime. It's only when you lift this whopper up off its bun a bit that you see that, yes, this guy did have weapons of mass destruction at one point, courtesy of the USA and our allies. Here is the list from a 1994 U.S. Senate report of the chemical agents we allowed U.S. corporations to sell to Saddam Hussein between 1985 and 1990. We gave Saddam Bacillus anthracis. Anthrax is an often fatal infectious disease due to ingestion of spores. It begins abruptly with high fever, difficulty in breathing, and chest pain. The disease eventually results in septicemia, blood poisoning, and the mortality rate is high. Once septicemia is advanced, antibiotic therapy may prove useless, probably because the exotoxins remain despite the death of the bacteria. Clostridium botulinum. A bacterial source of botulinum toxin, which causes vomiting, constipation, thirst, general weakness, headache, fever, dizziness, double vision, dilation of the pupils, and paralysis of the muscles involving swallowing. It is often fatal. Histoplasma capsulatum causes a disease superficially resembling tuberculosis that may cause pneumonia, enlargement of the liver and spleen, anemia, an influenza-like illness, and an acute inflammatory skin disease marked by tender red nodules, usually on the shins. Reactivated infection usually involves the lungs, the brain, spinal membranes, heart, peritoneum, and the adrenals. Brucella melitensis, a bacteria that can cause chronic fatigue, loss of appetite, profuse sweating when at rest, pain in joints and muscles, insomnia, nausea, and damage to major organs. Clostridium perfringens, a highly toxic bacteria that causes gas gangrene. The bacteria produce toxins that move along muscle bundles in the body, killing cells and producing necrotic tissue that is then favorable for further growth of the bacteria itself. Eventually, these toxins and bacteria enter the bloodstream and cause a systemic illness. In addition, several shipments of Escherichia coli, E. coli, and genetic materials, as well as human and bacterial DNA, were shipped directly to the Iraq Atomic Energy Commission. Records of U.S. corporate sales of biological material to Iraq before 1985 were not available. The Senate report also noted these exported biological materials were not attenuated or weakened and were capable of reproduction. The first two, anthrax and botulinum, were the cornerstone of Iraq's biological weapons program, all of it made wonderfully possible by the United States of America. As William Bloom reported in The Progressive, the report noted further that U.S. exports to Iraq included the precursors to chemical warfare agents, plans for chemical and biological warfare production facilities, and chemical warhead filling equipment. There are numerous other biological materials that could be used in biological weapons that were sent to Iraq during the 1980s and documented in the 1994 Senate report and through the Centers for Disease Control. All of the above came from American companies and were sent with the permission of the United States government during the Reagan-Bush years. Some of the companies include American Type Culture Collection, Alkalac International, Matrix Churchill Corporation, Solair Corporation, Pure Air, and Gorman Roop. American companies also were responsible for delivering Iraq dual-use technologies, including high-powered computers, lasers, and other items instrumental in the making of nuclear weapons and their components. As LA Weekly reported in 2003, Senate hearings and government records reveal that these companies included Hewlett-Packard, worked with Iraq from 1985 to 1990, supplying computers for an arm of the Iraqi government working on the Scud and nuclear programs. HP also sent computers to two government agencies that oversaw the nuclear and chemical weapons programs. Other sales included radar components and cryptographic equipment. AT&T, in 2000, was paid to optimize the products of another company, Huawei. Between 2000 and 2001, Iraq was paying Huawei to spiff up their air defense systems. Bechtel. From 1988 to 1990, it was helping the Iraqis build a giant petrochemical plant hand-in-hand with an Iraqi company known for its military ties. Caterpillar. Helped Iraq with construction of their nuclear program in the 1980s through the sale of $10 million worth of tractors. DuPont. in 1989, sold $30,000 worth of specially engineered oil to Iraq, which was used in their nuclear program. Kodak, also in 1989, sold $172,000 in equipment that was used in Iraq's missile programs. Hughes Helicopter, sold 60 helicopters to Iraq in 1983, which the Iraqis modified for military use. In all, from 1985 to 1990, the Department of Commerce approved the sale of $1.5 billion worth of dual-use technologies, from chemical and biological components to computers and equipment for conventional and nuclear weapon systems. In the same period, $308 million worth of aircraft, helicopters, and associated parts were also transferred to Iraq. But America was doing far more than just handing Saddam Hussein the stepping stones for chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. The Reagan-Bush White House was also hard at work securing even more military might for the Iraqi dictator. In August 2002, senior military officers revealed to the New York Times an even broader view of America's aid. Our boys in D.C. thought it would be a grand idea to give the Iraqis intelligence information and battle planning advice in the war against Iran, knowing full well that Iraq had used and would continue to use chemical weapons in these battles. You see, the administration had made the decision that Iraq could not lose the Iran-Iraq war, and that they would do everything they could legally to ensure that madman Saddam Hussein was victorious. Reagan went so far as to sign a national security directive backing this promise up. In a 1995 sworn affidavit, the directive's co-author and a member of Reagan's National Security Council, Howard Teicher, revealed even more about America's involvement. CIA Director Casey personally spearheaded the effort to ensure that Iraq had sufficient military weapons, ammunition, and vehicles to avoid losing the Iran-Iraq war. Pursuant to the secured National Security Directive, the United States actively supported the Iraqi war effort by supplying the Iraqis with billions of dollars of credits, by providing U.S. military intelligence and advice to the Iraqis, and by closely monitoring third country arms sales to Iraq to make sure that Iraq had the military weaponry required. One of those third country arms sales was of particular interest. Imagine our shock when it was discovered that our good despotic friends, the Saudis, had accidentally transferred 300 American-made MK-84 2,000-pound bombs to Iraq. For the most part, though, Reagan's handlers were smart enough to funnel weapons untraceably through other countries. It wasn't just his handlers who were getting involved. Reagan and Bush I decided to personally get their hands dirty. According to Teicher's affidavit, in 1986, President Reagan sent a secret message to Saddam Hussein telling him that Iraq should step up its air war and bombing of Iran. This message was delivered by Vice President Bush, who communicated it to Egyptian President Mubarak, who in turn passed the message to Saddam Hussein. Even after Saddam used his weapons of mass destruction to gas his own people, an event Bush and his buddies are so totally offended by now, a decade and a half too late, the Reagan administration was unfazed. The United States Congress tried to put economic sanctions on Hussein's country, but the White House quashed the idea. Their reasons? According to declassified State Department documents, economic sanctions might hurt America's chances at contracts for massive post-war reconstruction once the Iran-Iraq war finally came to a close. Weapons of mass destruction? Oh yeah, he had them at one time. All we had to do was check the receipts and count the profits as they rolled into the bank account of the campaign backers of Reagan and Bush. Number 3. Whopper with Bacon. Iraq has ties to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. As if having the atomic bomb, nerve gas, and the bubonic plague in a bottle wasn't enough, suddenly Saddam Hussein was in cahoots with the mother of all terrorists himself, Osama bin Laden. I'm sure you had the same reaction I did when you heard, "How much worse can it get? When can we get rid of this Saddam guy?" Just hours after the attacks on September 11, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had already figured out who was responsible, or at least who he wanted to punish. According to CBS News, Rumsfeld wanted as much information as possible about the attacks and told his fact-finding team to go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not. He already had intelligence indicating a connection to Osama, whom he called Usama, but he wanted more because he had other goals in mind. He wanted intelligence good enough to hit SH, Saddam Hussein, at the same time, not only UBL. WABOBS. I say Osama, you say Usama, and Rumsfeld just says the magic word Saddam, and before you know it, everyone else was saying it too. Retired General Wesley Clark has said that he received phone calls on September 11 and in the weeks after from people at think tanks and from people within the White House telling him to use his position as a pundit for CNN to connect September 11 to Saddam Hussein. He said he'd do it if someone could show him the proof. No one could. During the build-up to war in the fall of 2002, Bush and members of his administration kept repeating the claim, keeping it uncluttered by specifics, also known as facts. So it stayed nice and simple and easy to remember. Bush circled the country at campaign stops for Republican congressional candidates, inseminating the minds of the American people with the bogus Saddam-Osama connection on a continuous loop. Check out just 1 week's worth of serial lying. This Hussein is a person who can't stand America. This is a person who has had contacts with Al-Qaeda. George W. Bush, Alamogordo, New Mexico, October 28, 2002. He's a threat to America, and he's a threat to our friends. He's even more of a threat now that we've learned that he's anxious to have, once again, to develop a nuclear weapon. He's got connections with Al-Qaeda. George W. Bush, Denver, Colorado, October 28, 2002. This is a man who cannot stand what we stand for. He hates the fact, like Al-Qaeda does, that we love freedom. See, they can't stand that. This is a guy who has had connections with these shadowy terrorist networks. George W. Bush, Aberdeen, South Dakota, October 31, 2002. That's the nature of this man. We know he's got ties with Al-Qaeda. George W. Bush, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, November 1, 2002. We know that he's had connections with Al-Qaeda. George W. Bush, Tampa, Florida, November 2, 2002. This is a man who has had contacts with Al-Qaeda. This is a man who poses a serious threat in many forms. But catch this form. He's the kind of guy that would love nothing more than to train terrorists and provide arms to terrorists so they could attack his worst enemy and leave no fingerprints. This guy is a threat to the world. George W. Bush, St. Paul, Minnesota, November 3, 2002. This is a man who can't stand America and what we believe in. This is a man who hates some of our closest allies. This is a man who has had Al-Qaeda connections. George W. Bush, St. Louis, Missouri, November 4, 2002. This is the kind of guy we're dealing with. This is a man who hates America, he hates our friends, he can't stand what we believe in. He's had contacts with Al-Qaeda. George W. Bush, Bentonville, Arkansas, November 4, 2002. This is a man who cannot stand America. He cannot stand what we stand for. He can't stand some of our closest friends and allies. This is a man who has got connections with Al-Qaeda. George W. Bush, Dallas, Texas, November 4, 2002. Just in case we missed the point, Bush continued to hammer it home in his State of the Union address on January 28, 2003. Evidence from intelligence sources, secret communications, and statements by people now in custody reveal that Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda, Bush insisted. Immediately following the address, A CBS online poll found that support for U.S. military action in Iraq increased. A week later, on February 5, Bush's claims were echoed by Secretary of State Colin Powell in a lengthy address to the United Nations Security Council. After detailing what Powell said were Iraq's numerous failures to comply with weapons inspections, he moved on to the Saddam-Osama connection. But what I want to bring to your attention today is the potentially much more sinister nexus between Iraq and the Al-Qaeda network, a nexus that combines classic terrorist organizations and modern methods of murder. But the meat of the administration's evidence had already begun to turn rancid. During that same first week of February, a British intelligence report leaked to the BBC said there were no links between Saddam and Osama. The two evildoers had tried to form a friendship in the past, but it turned out like a great episode of Blind Date. They hated each other. According to the report, bin Laden's aims are in ideological conflict with present-day Iraq. On top of this, the Al-Qaeda poison and explosives factory Bush and his team claim Saddam was harboring was located in northern Iraq, an area controlled by Kurds and patrolled by U.S. and British warplanes since the early 90s. The north of Iraq was out of Saddam's reach, but within our own. The base actually belonged to Ansar al-Islam, a militant fundamentalist group whose leader has branded Saddam Hussein an enemy. A tour of the base by a large group of international journalists quickly revealed that no weapons were being manufactured there. But none of that mattered. The president had said it. It had to be true. Yes, this whopper worked so well that in the months leading up to the war in Iraq, polls showed that up to half of Americans said they believed that Saddam Hussein had ties to Osama bin Laden's network. Even before Bush had served up his 2003 State of the Union address and Powell had presented the Saddam-Osama evidence to the UN, a Knight Ridder poll found that half of those questioned already incorrectly thought that one or more of the 9/11 hijackers held Iraqi citizenship. Bush didn't even have to say it. The Bush administration had succeeded in perpetuating one of the biggest lies of all time, confusing Saddam with Osama in the minds of the American public. Once you sell the people on the notion that Saddam had a hand in the mass murder of nearly 3,000 people on American soil, well, even if the bogus weapons of mass destruction whopper didn't hold up, this would be enough to get the flags waving and the troops a-packing. Of course, the problem with this whopper, other than it is a cynical, premeditated fabrication, is that Osama bin Laden considers Saddam to be an infidel. Hussein committed the sin of creating a secular Iraq instead of a Muslim state run by fanatical Muslim clerics. Under Saddam, Baghdad had churches, mosques, and yes, even a synagogue. Hussein had persecuted and killed thousands and thousands of Shiites in Iraq because of the threat they posed to his secular government. In fact, the biggest reason Saddam and Osama don't like each other is the same reason the Bushes stopped liking Saddam, the invasion of Kuwait. Bush and company was pissed because Saddam was threatening the security of our oil in the Gulf, and Osama was pissed because it brought American troops to Saudi Arabia and the Muslim Holy Lands. That's bin Laden's biggest problem with us, and it's all because of Saddam. Saddam and Osama were mortal enemies, and they could not put their mutual hatred aside, even to join together to defeat the USA. Man, to not team up when it meant destroying the great Satan Bush, that is a lot of hate. Number 4 Whopper. Heavy on the pickles and onions. Saddam Hussein is the world's most evil man. Okay, he was bad. Really bad. He gassed the Kurds, gassed the Iranians, tortured the Shiites, tortured the Sunnis, tortured countless others, and during the sanctions against Iraq, let his people starve and suffer all types of deprivation while he hoarded money and kept his many palaces well stocked with provisions and a petting zoo for his nutcase adult sons. This is all gruesome stuff, and the world was right to condemn him and to support any efforts by the people of Iraq to have him removed. but the United States never gave a rat's ass about how badly Saddam the dictator treated his own people. We never care about that stuff. In fact, we like dictators. They help us get what we want, and they do a great job of keeping their nation subservient to our galloping global corporate interests. We have a long and proud history of propping up madmen and their regimes as long as it helps us rule the world. Obviously, there are our old pals the Saudis, and there's Saddam, and then there's these places where we proudly sowed our oats. Cambodia. After secretly extending the Vietnam War into Cambodia in the late 60s, and then watching the already decimated country slip under the control of Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge, the United States chose to support this madman for the simple reason that he offered opposition to the Vietnamese communists, who had just fought mighty America to total defeat. Then he took control and wiped out millions of his own people. The Congo, Zaire. The CIA got in bed with Mobutu Sese Seko early, setting off years of horrific violence that continues today. Afraid of the nationalist leader Patrice Lumumba, America helped Mobutu to power, oversaw the assassination of Lumumba, and then helped crush the resulting uprisings. Mobutu took dictatorial control, outlawed political activity, had people killed, and ruled the country until 1990.